Inauguration of American presidents is always a time of great peace and great hope and expectation in our country. March the 4th, 1864, Abraham Lincoln went to Washington, D.C., where he gave his second inaugural address. The Civil War was still in progress, and the president mentioned that conflict, also talked about slavery, and alluded to the fact that both North and South worshiped the same Lord, read the same Bible, and prayed to the same God that he would destroy the other side. And then he ended his brief speech by saying, "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, and to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." Less than a century later, John F. Kennedy went to the same city and gave his inaugural address. Included among the things that he said were these words: "We observe today not a victory of party, but a celebration of freedom, symbolizing an end as well as a beginning, signifying renewal as well as change. Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and success of liberty. Now the trumpet summons us again, not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though embattled we are, but as a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, a struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself." If you go back and read through the inaugural speeches of American presidents, you find that there is one constant theme. That's hope, expectation, that we finally have people in power who can do the things that need to be done, that we can now right the wrongs that have beset our society. Well, that theme was picked up by two songwriters, Milton Edgar and Jack Yeller. In 1929, when they wrote a little tune that came out on the radio just before the stock market crash, some of the words of that song: "So long, sad times, go along, bad times, we're rid of you at last. Howdy, gay times, cloudy gray times, you're now a thing of the past, 'cause happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again, let's sing a song of cheer again, happy days are here again." In 1734, Alexander Pope wrote his Essay on Man, four different letters that he had originally written to a member of the House of Commons, Henry Bolingbroke. And in the essay, Pope argues that God has given us here in this world, despite all the tyranny and the war, despite the disease and the injustice, that he has given us here the best of all possible worlds to live in. And while we may not be able to see it because our vision is not wide enough, this is still the best of all worlds. And then Pope, partway through the essay, says, "Hope springs eternal in the human breast." Well, Pope is no doubt right about the hope that continually pops up in our society. And it seems to come at certain times: the coronation of a new king, the inauguration of a president, the beginning of a new year, a new job, a new mate. And yet it's one of the great ironies of human life that the things that give us the greatest hope often issue the greatest disappointment. And so the monarch becomes a dictator and the president fails to deliver. And the new year is just a repeat of the old year. And we don't like the mate and we despise the job. Well, this tension between hope and disappointment is what Isaiah takes up in his 8th and 9th chapters. Up until his point in time, Israel had lived under 34 different kings, as varied as David and Solomon, from Asa to Uzziah, the two Jeroboams, Ahab and Ahaz. And yet those years have been filled with war and with poverty, with depression, discouragement, been filled with lack of justice and abuse. And even the reign of the current king was nothing to be very proud of. And so Isaiah concludes his 8th chapter by commenting on the administration of Ahaz, the current ruler in Judah. "The people will pass through the land," he says, "greatly distressed and hungry. And when they are hungry, they will be enraged, and they will curse their king and their God and turn their faces upward. And they will look to the earth, but behold, distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they will be thrust into deep darkness." But then Isaiah turns his sights not, necessarily totally to the past and the present, but also the future. And he opens chapter 9 of Isaiah by comparing the reign of Ahaz with a future monarch. Listen to what he says. "But there will be no gloom for the people that was in anguish. In the former time, God brought content into the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, God will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness, they'll now see a great light. Those who have dwelt in the land of deep darkness, on them has the light shined. You've multiplied the nation, O God. You've increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder and the rod of his oppressor you have broken in battle as on the day of Midian. Every boot of the trampling warrior in battle tumult, every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire." And so Isaiah compares the rule of the current monarch with this monarch to come. You live in gloom and doom, but a monarch's coming is going to bring light. These have been discouraging, depressing times for you, but there will be joy and rejoicing in the future, he says. You've lost nearly every battle, but the day is coming when you'll win every battle. There have been failures, but a day of success is coming. And we wonder if it's not a bit like some of the inaugural addresses that our presidents have made. Happy times are here again. That there's new hope, new expectation, that hope springs eternal in the human breast. But then Isaiah turns up the volume. Listen to what he says in verses 6 and 7. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore." In those two verses, Isaiah points out the four qualities of the king and the four qualities of the kingdom. He'll be a counselor, but not just a counselor, but he'll be a wonderful counselor, a mighty counselor, a counselor who will do miracles and heavenly things. He'll be a God, but not just a God. He'll be a mighty God, a God who will be a hero, who will be a warrior for the people. And he'll be a father, but not just a father, but he'll be an everlasting father, a father who's always near, who never leaves us. He'll not just be a peacemaker, but he'll be the prince of peacemakers. He'll not just bring an absence of war, but he'll bring blessing into the land. And then after the four qualities of the coming king, the four qualities of his kingdom, it'll be a kingdom that he has control over. It'll be a kingdom of power, number one. It'll be a kingdom that will bring peace to the land. It will be a kingdom that will establish justice for those who have been abused and put down. And number four, it will be a kingdom of righteousness. And we wonder if Isaiah is just a great speech writer, or if indeed there is some very unusual person who's coming. For no king has ever lived up to this kind of heights. No president has ever made this kind of promise, these kinds of promises. No government has ever lived out this kind of administration. There's no campaigner that puts these kinds of promises in the glossy campaign brochures. Because what Isaiah is calling for here is nothing less than a complete reversal of the way we think of government and the way we think of leadership. There will not be petty fights among his administration, but this governor, this king, will be in control. And instead of a dozen hot spots around the world where war is allowed to continue, there will be perfect peace in the time of this king. And this king will bring a kingdom that will bring justice for all people of all nationalities and genders and races and colors. And instead of infidelity on the royal yacht, and instead of dishonesty in the White House, this king will bring righteousness and purity to his kingdom. And it won't be just a child that will turn up the music of the volume of Happy Days Are Here Again so loud that it drowns out the cries of the poor and the oppressed. But he's going to be a king that will rule with power. And he'll be a king that will bring peace. And he'll bring righteousness. And he'll bring justice to the land. And we wonder, who is this king? And when is he to come? People in Isaiah's day thought it was Hezekiah, that great 8th century ruler in Jerusalem who restored some of the laws of God. A century later, they were saying it was Josiah, the one who expanded the boundaries of the kingdom, the one that was going to put to death the Pharaoh of Egypt and was finally going to get freedom from that awful menace. And 100 years later, they thought, no, it's Zerubbabel, the one who's going to bring us back from Babylonian exile, rebuild the city of Jerusalem, rebuild the walls of the gates and the temples. And even a little later, it was Judas Maccabees that they thought would be this king. But yet each one of those and the others that were suggested in his own way didn't have the power and didn't bring the peace and didn't offer the justice or the righteousness that Isaiah said this king would bring and offer. And then in the time of the Caesars, in the days of the Herods, a baby was born in Bethlehem who seemed to have no power at all, and certainly no platform for world peace, and no means to establish justice and righteousness in the land. And yet the baby was the wonderful Counselor, and the mighty God, and the everlasting Father, and the Prince of Peace. And He brought a kingdom that the world had never seen, a kingdom not of land, but a kingdom of spirits and souls, a kingdom that without a capital, but a kingdom with a following, with a cause, a kingdom not with an army, but a kingdom with masses of people giving allegiance, a kingdom ruled by a man not from a throne, but by a man on a cross. And it was to be a complete reversal of all the kingdoms that people had ever known. It was to be a kingdom that would bring in power. There would be no power plays in His kingdom. It would be a kingdom that would bring in peace, peace for all people everywhere. It would be a kingdom that would bring in justice and righteousness for all folks of all lands. And yet, people have misunderstood this king, and they've missed this king, and they've looked for him in Christmas trees and in men dressed in red and white suits with wide black belts, and they've looked for him in churches, but they've often not found this king because he's been misunderstood and missed. A book came out a few years ago entitled Beauty is a Ring in My Nose. It's about a man and a wife who spent 50 years working among the Kuna Indians on an island just off the coast of Panama. Lonnie and Manly went there as arbitrators and teachers, carpenters and helpers. And the men of the village would meet once a month in a large hut at the center of their village, grass roof overhead, to discuss various affairs. Lonnie would go and he would ask to speak. And he would talk to the men that were assembled about Jesus and about God. And then he would pick up his Spanish Bible and he'd begin to read to them in Spanish. And when he started reading in Spanish, the Indians would quit listening. And they would say, "Your God doesn't speak our language." They said, "We know the Spanish. We know the Spanish gold hunters that came, and we know what they did to our forefathers." And Lonnie realized that he would have to translate the Bible into a language that wasn't even written down. And so he composed an alphabet made up of 17 characters. And the first story that he translated into the Kuna language was the story about the birth of the king in Bethlehem. And so on another day, when the warriors were all gathered some 400 strong in the hut in the middle of the village, Lonnie stood up and he took his piece of paper and he started reading about the story in Bethlehem. And the chief of the Indians interrupted him and he said, "Is that paper speak the Kuna language? Is that Kuna? Is that Kuna on the paper?" Lonnie said, "Yes, it is." And 400 Indians stood. They removed their hats and listened in silence, reverence, as Lonnie read the rest of the story. And when the story was over and the group had been dismissed, the Indians were overheard saying to one another, "The baby born in the manger was Kuna." What may be that we miss Jesus, just as many people in history have missed Him. It may be that He seems to be too plastic in a world that wants something real, that He seems to be irrelevant in a world that wants something pertinent. He seems to be too far away in a world that wants something close. He seems to come in language we don't understand in a world that desperately wants to comprehend. And it's a problem that Isaiah had. He spoke words that the people didn't understand. He spoke speeches that the people couldn't comprehend. And it's a problem we have this morning. What can I say to you to convince you that He was the wonderful Counselor? What words can I pull out that would say He is the mighty God, that He is the everlasting Father? How can I convey to you that He was the Prince of Peace? Clark Kimberly Oler preached at Holy Trinity Church in New York City for a number of years. And he told one year of seeing a young boy come by the church, press his face against the wrought iron fence out front. He always could recognize me, wore the same dirty red stocking cap, oversized coat, dirty blue jeans, old sneakers. And he came by several times and looked into the garden, and Oler tried to go out to talk to the boy, to find out who he was and where he lived and what he might need, but every time the boy looked back at the preacher in distrust, ran down the street into an alley. Lynn Oler says that one Christmas Eve, he was working late in the study. The streets were deserted. It was dark. It was snowing. There was only one light. It was a large spotlight on the nativity scene in the church's garden, life-size figures of the shepherds and the wise men and Mary and Joseph and the baby and the animals gathered around with real straw underneath. And as he looked out through the window, he saw the red stocking cap. The little boy was back. It's Christmas Eve. And timidly at first, he opened the gate and walked in and finally stood in front of the replica of the Nativity. And he stood there for about 30 minutes, looking and watching. Then Oler said he did an odd thing. The little boy went and crawled into the straw at Mary's feet. And he knew that if he went out, if he tapped on the window, if he made any attempt to contact the boy, he'd be gone in a flash. And so he just watched. And every minute or two, a little hand would come up and touch Mary's cheek. Then something disturbed the boy, and he was up and gone. The world is filled with people like that little boy. Perhaps some here this morning who are lost, who are lonely, who are homeless, who are not loved, not cared for, wanting desperately just to touch a mother's cheek, or to cuddle up in the straw, or to have some source of warmth. And yet they run away, or we run away, sometimes because of the obligation, sometimes because of what people will say and think, sometimes because we think we're not good enough or because we're not bad enough yet, and so we run away, not quite convinced that He's the wonderful Counselor, not certain that He's the mighty God, not at all sure that He's the everlasting Father or the Prince of Peace. From the time that Isaiah first penned these words or spoke these words down to when the Kuna Indians heard the story of the birth in Bethlehem in their own language, He's been misunderstood. He's been missed. From the time that He was born in the Bethlehem manger to the little boy in the red stocking cap slept in the snow in front of Mary. From the time that He died on the cross to this very holiday week, people have misunderstood. And they've looked for hope and they've placed their expectations on sinking sand and other places, hoping, praying that that would be the source of guidance for their life when all along, it was Jesus who's the wonderful Counselor and the mighty God, the everlasting Father, and the Prince of Peace. One of the symbols of the holiday season for us has always been the Christmas tree. I suspect nearly all of us have one in our homes. Put lights on it and decorations, things that children have made, a star at the top, or perhaps an angel. Presents underneath, so many perhaps that the bottom branches are almost in the way of the presents. And perhaps the symbol we should have at the front this morning should be a Christmas tree. Oh, not with the decorations, not with the tinsel, not with the star, not with the packages. In fact, not even with the needles. In fact, not even with most of the branches, but just the upright and two branches near the top. One in each direction, reminding us that the King born in the manger was crowned King on the cross. There's no better time to begin a walk with God, with Jesus, than now. Would you come as we stand and sing?